Welcome to the Diplomacy Cast.
Eight, seven, six, five, four, three, two, one, deadline.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to the first ever episode of Diplomacy Cast. Diplomacy Cast is a podcast about the board game Diplomacy from Hasbro. My name's Eric Mead, and this is my co-host, Nathan Barnes. How are you today, Nathan?
I'm feeling awesome and electric and excited.
And stabby.
Stabby. Super stabby.
Great. So in the first ever episode, we will introduce ourselves, and then we'll introduce two new segments, Table Talk, in which we define some diplomacy jargon, and Power Plays, in which we spotlight a different country every week.
And don't forget, we also have the great Chris Martin, winner of just about everything under the sun.
We'd love to hear your feedback. Email us at press@diplomacycast.com, and be sure to subscribe to us on iTunes. Well, you've found a podcast out there that is about the board game Diplomacy, and what we're going to attempt to do over the next few episodes, and hopefully over the next many, many episodes over a while, is we're going to try and be a resource for those of you who play the game Diplomacy, and who are interested in learning more about the game of Diplomacy and getting better at it.
And anyone out there that's interested in learning about tournament play, maybe online players who are looking to transition into something bigger and better, or just wanting to connect with other people in the Diplomacy community, that's something we're hoping it's going to happen.
That's right. First and foremost, though, we want to be a resource, like I said. And by resource, I suppose the main thing that we're going to focus on, at least early on in this podcast, is we're going to focus on the strategy and tactics of the game.
As well as, we also, I think we had mentioned earlier, we want to do a little bit more about tournaments and what's going on in the community right now. We've been playing this game 8 to 10 years. Some of us, like myself, a little bit longer than others.
Yeah. Only 8 years here. Nathan's really got me beat. You know, that's really what's important to Nathan at all times, is
winning.
As long as he's a little more than me.
Winning.
Yeah.
That's why I play this game.
Yeah.
And tournament organization, I think there's definitely a lot of folks out there that find it a little bit mysterious, and having organized, on my part, many, many tournaments, hoping to impart that a little bit.
Yeah, Nathan has more experience in the organization of tournaments than I do. I've always sort of just showed up at them and let other people entertain me with all of their hard work, which is something I feel a little bit bad about, and that's part of the reason I thought that maybe I should try and give a little something back to the world of Diplomacy, and that's why I thought of this podcast idea.
Yeah, and I'm excited to be a part of it as much as I can. One of the things that we're going to talk about, as Eric said, is strategy. These first couple of episodes, we're going to focus on just some basic how do you play a country.
Yeah, we figured that early on, there's probably a lot of you out there who are playing the game, maybe playing online, and you're just trying to get better one way or the other. And so we thought maybe a little bit of a spotlight on each of the individual 7 powers might be something that's helpful.
It certainly would have been helpful for me. I know that I spent hours looking around online for the best way to play a certain country to get that killer move and that killer strategy, which never quite panned out, but
yep.
I learned a lot on the way.
Diplomacy is one of those games that doesn't matter how long you've been playing it, how much you've won, you can always get better. There's people that have been playing this game for 30, 40 years, and they're learning new things about it, as we know.
Some have been playing for 30, 40 years and refuse to learn as well.
Yeah, some of them have played for 30, 40 years, and they never get any better. Bless their hearts, but, you know, they show up at our tournaments, and they provide us with dots when we need them.
Yes,
but
they're very kind.
Yes, very generous people. Another thing that we wanted to cover was, well, honestly, we sort of have a secret agenda that Nathan alluded to a little bit. We're also interested in getting those of you who are out there who like the game, who play the game, but aren't necessarily competitive in the game. We want to see you guys out at tournaments. Another important thing that we hadn't mentioned yet about this is that we're going to try and bring you a guest every week. Someone out there in the world of diplomacy that maybe has been winning a lot or has a lot of history in the world of tournaments that we think that maybe their insights might be differently interesting to you. We're going to bring you some tournament organizers, some competitive players, some people who have won impressive things in the past, and interview them, try and pick their brains and find out a little bit about.
And as we go, I'm sure that that somewhat small group will expand. We'll hopefully get people that are new to the game and get their perspectives and just generally have an interesting program to learn a little bit more about diplomacy in a fun and interactive way.
Yeah. Nathan and I know a lot of people in diplomacy, but we don't know everyone in diplomacy, and we'd like to, and we hope that this podcast serves as something that will allow us to get to know people.
So with that, I think we'll transition into our first segment.
Our first segment, we're calling Table Talk.
Clever.
Very clever, because it's alliterative. People like that.
Yeah.
No, catchy, podcasty.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. The news media has been sucking on that for eons.
Oh, for sure. In Table Talk, we like to talk about some of the terminology that we use all of the time, because for those of you who are newer to the game, you're going to find Nathan and I have a lot of silly lingo.
Right, and we, when thinking about this, we realize that we were almost talking a jargon or in a code. So we wanted to make sure that we had a little bit of a section of this podcast where we kind of explain what it is we were saying.
So for our first Table Talk section, I thought that it might be important to cover a little bit about how the game gets scored. There's one thing that you all know, and that's that you're supposed to get to 18 centers, and if you do, you win.
And the other thing you know is that, well, you might know, almost never does anyone actually get there.
So, after that, it gets a little foggy. All the rules say on the subject is that
it's a draw.
It's a draw. If nobody gets to 18 centers, it's a draw. I don't even know if the rules use that word.
They do say draw.
He does say draw. Absolutely. So, nobody really knows what that means, though. So, is it better if everybody is still on the board?
Well, what happens in tournament play is every tournament somehow has a different, slightly different structure as to how they award points for that. And this is important because we like to figure out who the best is and who the least best is. We want to be able to rank everyone.
We have to have some way of giving out the trophies.
Right, everybody wants their wood.
So to speak. And so there's a lot of different methods that people have agreed on, and nobody's ever happy with any of them, but we thought we'd maybe kind of cover a couple of what the different ones are.
Which is important, really, and fundamentally why we're doing this is when we talk about a strategy that could net you a better position or more dots or what have you, it's in the context of expanding your score under certain scoring systems.
Exactly. So most tournaments, I should say, most U.S. tournaments over the past 10 years or so.
Sure.
Have had the idea that it's better if less people are in the draw than if fewer people are in the draw than if more people are in the draw.
Thank you for being so grammatically correct.
Yeah. And this is something that you might disagree with. You know, you as a diplomacy player, you might say that if I don't get the solo, then to me a six-way draw is the same as a three-way draw. I don't care.
And there's quite a few people out there like that. However, in the last, I would say, 4 to 5 years, there's definitely been a move away from that, and that's been very reactionary to the predominance of the draw-based scoring systems that really you saw at tournaments for, I would say, the last 20 years.
So you said draw-based, and that's usually how we're going to refer to it. So why don't you tell me basically what a draw-based scoring system is? We'll start with that as a baseline.
Well, typically, and this is one of the appeals of a draw-based system, is it's fairly simple. It just assigns a point value to the number of individuals in your draw.
With the assumption that smaller is better.
Right. So obviously, the smallest draw is 1, 18 centers.
That's not a draw.
Right. They rank it at the top, but that person would get X score. Let's say 100, because it's easy.
Sure.
then you would look at maybe a two-way draw that involves only two people winning. Fairly rare, 75 points.
Yeah.
Three-way draw, 60 points. Four-way draw, you know, you would just go down like
right,
that.
Right, and then everybody who's in the draw gets
that many points.
That many points, and everybody who's not in the draw
gets, depending on the scoring system.
Yeah, right, gets a few or no points, so which is another thing. Some of them, although in practice at tournaments they don't really do this, but generally you'll hear the phrase DIAS, which is an acronym, D-I-A-S, draws include all survivors. This means that if you want to call the three-way draw, you have to mop every last piece of opposition off of the darn board in order to actually get it.
Which is time-consuming and fairly unpleasant.
And really pretty cruel. Yeah.
It actually really is.
That you have these guys trying to hang on to their one center to attempt to do it. The alternative to a DIAS system is with some kind of a concept of you're allowed to vote yourself out of the draw. If you'd rather just go out and eat dinner than right. continue defending your last two dots for another half an hour, you can just say, all right, I think this is basically where the game's ending. That's the most common system.
Right, because it's a little bit kinder to everyone involved. I mean, the only risk you have there is that someone abandons a completely legitimate position and just gives up.
Yeah.
But typically, it lets people that have two or three centers left give the coalition the win and, you know, go off and have some drinks with their friends or have dinner or whatever, rather than have to sit there while that three-way alliance just grinds them out of the game.
Yeah. At half an hour per year,
exactly.
Nobody's having fun doing it. It can happen that way. Also, some tournaments, as we alluded to, some tournaments will award a few points for dots you still have left on the board, and so sometimes it can actually be in your tournament interest to vote yourself out. You can go, well, I've got three now. I know they're all going to kill me. I'd rather just take my 3 points because right. at least that's something.
And that helps to expedite the game a
yeah.
little bit.
Yeah. Now, the alternative to any kind of a draw-based system is, well, a centers-based system, score-based system, I suppose, where they would give you, they don't care how many people are left on the board when the game ends, they just care how big you are.
Yeah, the philosophy here is that you, no matter what the board position looks like, the closer you got to the Magic 18 number, the better off, theoretically, you were.
Yeah. Because in a pure draw-based scoring system, as we mentioned before, if you have 5 centers but you're part of the three-way draw, you're the same as the guy who had 16 centers in part of the three-way draw.
And under the center-based sort of system, under that philosophy, it doesn't matter that you're at a stalemated position at 15, you can never possibly grow. You're going to get a lot more points than someone else.
So the reason we thought that this was important to talk about right off the bat, in case you're getting bored, is that we thought that that the strategies that we're going to talk about for the different powers are going to be different depending on what system you're playing under. If you're playing under a pure draw-based system,
Well, turkey's a lot better to have.
Right.
there's a great example.
You hang out there, you get bashed forever, and then everybody else realizes that you're necessary, and suddenly you have a part of a draw and you've done well. Whereas employing that strategy in a system where you have to get big fast.
Right. You're never going to be as big as a France under equal circumstances. You just cannot get there.
Right. That, I think, covers it for Table Talk for today. Of course, if you have any turns that you would like to find, please send us an email.
And there's always more to talk about with scoring systems. I'm sure we'll be back.
Oh, yeah. Yes, welcome to our main segment today, Power Plays. Today we're going to be talking about England.
The country you probably want to draw out of a hat if you've never played diplomacy before.
Yeah, that's something I've always heard. It's England's reputation that it's sort of simple to play, and I suppose I understand that. It's safe, it's isolated, you don't really have to talk to that many people at the beginning, which sort of limits your options.
Right, I think if you're a new player and you really only have those 3 people to talk to, and you're on an island, you don't, you're not going to accidentally move to the wrong space, really.
Yeah, yeah. So I guess that makes it a good first podcast for us to do, because it's simple and there's less that we can screw up also. So,
and in addition, we are also going to have a guest.
Oh, yeah, Chris Martin. Chris is really fun to talk to about England. He has all sorts of zany ideas about it.
Perhaps because it's a newer player thing. He's a character. You'll enjoy it.
Yeah, you'll see. But you don't get that yet. That's like the dessert, and we're the meat and potatoes of your diplomacy podcast here. And so we're going to tell you a little bit of our thoughts about the country of England first. All right, Nathan, you're at the tournament. You just reached into the hat, and you drew that dark blue piece. What's your immediate reaction?
Well, I'm relieved I didn't draw Germany. And I'm excited because I really enjoy playing England. I think there's a lot of fun you can have with it.
Yep.
It really is a fleet power, which can produce a lot of convoys and a lot of fun.
Yep.
But it's also, if I pull bad neighbors, I know I have a reasonable chance of defending against it.
And when you say bad neighbors, you mean neighbors who have all decided that they want to kill you.
No, yeah, not just people I don't like. I mean, yeah. People that just want to take me out of the game, yes.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Which, you know, it happens to the best of us. It happens
to all of us.
yes, it does. So if we're talking maybe the strengths and the weaknesses of England, for example, I'd say, as we mentioned before, one of the strengths is that they're isolated. They're very hard to dig all the way out and eliminate. England, along with Turkey, a lot of people used to call them the Wicked Witches, the Wicked Witch of the West and Wicked right. Witch of the East. And the reason for that is because if you ever really do decide that you want to just go beat the heck out of them, good luck to you.
Right. It's a pain in the ass.
Yeah.
Like they're entrenched, and you really need. You can never do it by yourself,
yeah.
Unless it's in the. If it's in the late game, maybe you can. But, I mean, early on, you're going to need at least two other countries to help you get one of those people dug out.
Yep. And even then, every once in a while, they'll sit there on, you know, one or two or three dots and just stick their tongue out at you and say, ha ha ha, you're never getting my last center. And if you do, it'll take you so long that something will happen on the other side of the board. And so,
well, that very real strength of almost ensuring that you're going to get at least probably to the mid game.
Yeah.
Really, you're able to influence the board quite a bit, but it's also a double-edged sword because you also can be very, very isolated.
Yeah.
And quite easily. You still are playing technically, but I have more than once grounded three armies on England and trapped three armies in Turkey. I mean, it can be done.
Yeah. It really is a deeply satisfying feeling, though.
If
you're playing against somebody in England and all of a sudden they realize all they have is armies and they're out of fleets and all of their armies are just sitting there on the island, and then
beautiful.
You're just like, we'll come back for you.
We're gonna go.
Yeah. So anyway, don't let that happen to you. I suppose that's a weakness of playing England, to get back to the script here. The strength is that they're relatively secure. The weakness is that they can be isolated. And I suppose a weakness is it's harder to get 18.
Wait, yes. It's not as hard as Turkey, but it's hard.
I don't know if I agree with that, but we'll
save
that
later.
Yeah. If you're not planning to solo from a very, very early stage and focusing on those dots that are far away, but you're going to need to get to 18 eventually, you're going to have a hard time getting to that 18. You see a lot of England's do really well, think, aha, this is great, I'm winning the game, get to 14, 15, 16, and they're done.
Right, which is why, reviewing our stats, I think 92% of the time you are in a survival. If you pull England, I'm about 90%. But neither one of us have a tournament solo under our belts.
Yeah, it's true.
It's hard.
It's true. It's relatively easy to get to 13s and 12s and 14s, and extremely difficult to get that one across the line.
But importantly, if you know what you're doing, easy to survive.
Definitely. You can just make yourself too much of a pain to actually bother to eliminate.
Right.
And
in a certain scoring system, that's absolutely huge.
Right. Okay, moving on, a little bit about your neighbors when you're England and how you're going to interact with your neighbors, particularly early in the game.
Right, and I think And I agree with the way we're going to go with this, but I think the most important thing to talk about when we're talking about Neighbors is what everyone's already thinking about it, and that's the channel.
Of course.
Everybody wants to know about the channel.
To be fair, Nathan is actually always thinking about the English channel.
Yes, when I go to sleep, when I go out to drinks at bars, I'm secretly in the back of my head, I'm really thinking about the English channel.
I just wish I was in the channel right now. This is a good time.
It's so
having.
Bitter.
No, it's so true. Bitter. It's so true.
So a lot of, obviously the person most interested in this is France. France typically wants to know whether or not England's going to do that. Germany's also super interested.
Yep.
In fact, Russia is also interested. And you'll find most of your first year when talking to your neighbors, it's going to be all about the channel.
All about the channel, yeah. No one really cares what you're doing with that army in Liverpool.
Not really, no. Because it's not going anywhere.
Yeah. It's going to do something. It has two choices, and hold is not one of them. And so whether London is going to open to the English Channel or London is going to open to the North Sea, I'd say, I mean, we're going to talk a little more about specific openings a little bit down the line, but it's obviously just the English Channel is just one of those flashpoint spaces. It's one of those things where France is either going to go there or he's not, and you're either going to go there or you're not.
Right, and not to contrast it with the witches again, but you know, the Black Sea is the same way.
Yeah.
There's another body of water that entrance into it really sets the tone.
Yeah, I'd say the difference with the Black Sea is that bouncing in the Black Sea is not a total disaster.
Absolutely.
For both countries, whereas bouncing in the English Channel is a total disaster. There's no time you should be playing England where you and France get together and say, let's just bounce.
Yeah, well, you might as well just be saying, let's waste our time and not do well.
Yeah, so I would say that more often than not, England and France, well, I don't know if this is a fair thing to say or not. I was about to say England and France just decide both not to go there.
Well, because you're preserving the possibility of an EF, which is a very, very strong coalition. If you can get that alliance together, you're going to roll. I mean, it's not as good as a steamroller, but it's dominant.
I don't know what a steamroller is, but
we'll define it in the next one.
All right, fair enough.
An RT.
That's a juggernaut. We'll call it a steamroller. On this show, it's the steamroller.
I'm mixing it up with my 1900. You're right.
Yeah. The main thing again that you're going to be talking about with France is whether or not something's going to happen in the English Channel. The typical, in my experience, the way that the negotiation goes is you both just say, "I'm not going to the Channel," and
I'm not
going
to go to the Channel.
And then sometimes someone does.
The dirty secret is, all you England players, literally, there's a statistic out there. France almost never goes to the Channel. The only time France goes to the Channel is in a very specific circumstance that we'll talk about later. But typically, he has to have at least two powers behind him to do it.
Yeah. And the reason for that, of course, is that France would much prefer to open to the Mid-Atlantic Ocean, because
Absolutely. Then
he can get his nice, easy Iberian centers, Portugal and Spain, that nobody is even touching. And so he'd rather. So when you're England, you need to be thinking, France urgently doesn't want to go there. So as long as I don't have bad breath or in some other way really upset France right away, he'll probably just listen to me when I suggest that we'd rather go somewhere else.
Right, because he wants to believe that already.
So, yes. So the question then becomes, are you going there?
Right, and I think we'll get into that.
Okay.
We'll get into that. Well, let's talk about Germany next.
Okay.
Because France desperately wants to go someplace else, and your job is to really talk with him, try to get an alliance with him, because it's stronger than an alliance with Germany, most likely. We can talk about that.
Yeah.
But if we're just talking about if everybody's a robot, if all the pieces, if everyone's just going to move their pieces around, the EF is going to be stronger than the EG, just simply because you have less powers around Germany to eat away at the base.
The difference, I would say, the counter-argument to that, and you can agree or disagree, but the counter-argument to that is that an England-Germany alliance can pound on France and Russia at the same time, and France and Russia can't particularly help each other, because they're not neighbors.
Absolutely, but you have this Austrian sort of dark horse there that can really undermine things.
Yeah. It depends on what's going on in Austria.
Well,
but
and as with everything diplomacy, as we'll hear about,
it depends.
It depends on who's in the driver's seat.
Yeah,
really.
Yeah. So, I mean, if you're trying to choose between, I mean, I would say that Wests generally early on, Wests actually do just go, all right, is there going to be an England-Germany, an England-France, or a France-Germany early on? I mean, obviously, there's a ton of variance on that. There's certainly Western triples, which I hate to have to talk about, but I suppose we will have to talk about them at some point, because I hate them, and I never do them. The Western triple...
You're not playing right now. You know that, right? You're not diploming anybody here.
You guys are having a Western triple, aren't you? I'm freaking out. The Western triples being an alliance where England, France, and Germany all at least claim that they're allies early on, and it actually kind of works.
Oh, it does kind of work. I mean, it works really well for England.
Yeah, so it's great for England.
If you're England and someone
I'll just stand back here and get dots while you guys go take all the risk. Yeah, for sure.
Look for the dotted line, sign it in blood, have a great time, because you're going to do quite well.
Yeah. Your one last neighbor that we do need to talk about is Russia. Yeah, Russia. Yeah. It's really important, and actually, I'd say the more Englands I play, the more I find I'm talking with Russia early on. What? Nathan made a face at me. I'm not sure why.
The key to winning as England is really, you know, St. Petersburg.
Well... Moscow, really. It's just that early on in the game, there's the Scandinavian stuff that's going on. And what I find is that the German and the Russian aren't having a war that often. Because basically Germany wants to be involved either in the English player's ocean, or in France's mainland. He would prefer that to fighting Russia. Russia would prefer to be involved in the south and just let somebody have him Sweden, and then hope for the best.
Right. The RG conflicts tend to come closer to mid-game, and whoever wins is the one who jumps first.
Yeah. And everybody sort of accepts when you're playing England, in my experience, that Norway belongs to you already. So that means there's these other dots up there that are like, you know, Sweden... and Denmark, which Germany thinks he gets right away, which is fine.
He does
get right away. And then Russia just, like I said, kind of hopes for Sweden. And plus, Russia has St. Petersburg, but sometimes makes not really much effort to protect it. And so there's actually some almost risk-free growth for an English player up there if the diplomatic situation is right.
Right. I mean,
And Germany, never mind. Sorry. Go ahead.
No. I would only say that your risk is mitigated by what's going on in France. Because the only way that's risk-free is if you can devote the resources to it.
I guess I mean that nobody is ever really that mad at you for campaigning in Scandinavia. Whereas if you're campaigning in France's mainland or Germany's mainland, somebody's usually pretty mad at you.
Yeah, okay, there's much less heated argument.
Yeah.
Absolutely, I agree with that.
Yeah, so early negotiation with the Russian player is generally going to be something to the effect of Russia comes to you and says, hey, are you friends with Germany? If so, will you tell him I heart him and that I would like very much to have Sweden and have him not keep me from having Sweden, which is boring, but that's usually what Russian players do. They don't usually come and say, hey, let's work together and go attack Germany, at least not in the first year. And if they do, well, cool.
Yeah, if they do, great.
Yeah, then you can come up with interesting things to do there.
Depending on who they are.
Yeah, right. Exactly right.
they might not be honest with you.
Yeah, depending if they're doing it because they're so smart or because they're so stupid. It's one of the two.
So Russia, definitely a place to go. I hear you saying, and I agree with you.
Oh.
It's not my strategy, but I agree with you.
And the other thing that he wants is for you to not convoy an army over to Norway when you do take it.
Oh, no, he hates that.
Yeah. And the one thing that you want from him early on, obviously, is you don't want him to open with a second piece north, because if he opens Moscow to St. Petersburg, that's pretty anti-English, because now he can actually deny you Norway sometimes. And at least just, he's sort of declaring that he's really interested in Scandinavia. And sometimes they do, but...
Right, and...
So you want to talk him out of that, as
well. And that's getting dangerously close to openings.
Yeah.
And we're definitely going to talk in great detail about that.
Yep.
But before we, let's round out the board here. We have Italy, okay. Austria, and Turkey we need to discuss.
Yep.
So you've pulled England.
If I'm on the clock... I say, hey, Turkey, let's have a two-way draw. And that's pretty much my only opening negotiation with Turkey. Although we do have a neighbor in common. We do have Russia.
Absolutely.
And if I have more time, if I'm not slammed for time and he's not slammed for time, I'll take a minute and I'll go and I'll talk to the Turk and I'll say, hey, what are you thinking? Pro-Russia? Anti-Russia? Because that might affect my decision-making about how far north I'm going. Hey, has he said anything about wanting to open north? Okay.
Right. I'll always talk to Turkey about that.
Yeah, you know, Turkey does the job of putting pressure on the backsides of people that you might be interested in more than... He's very, very far. Your pieces probably are never going to border.
But to that extent, like, every power borders one of your neighbors.
Yeah, definitely.
I mean, you're always going to want to at least check in and, you know...
For sure.
You know... Open the embassy doors, as it were.
Yeah, oh, for sure. There's nothing worse than when you get to the part of the game when you actually need that neighbor's help, and he's just like, oh, now you're talking to me.
Yeah. Oh, they are not happy.
Yeah, no. Oh, all of a sudden you want to talk. Okay. Yeah, yeah. So
definitely chat
be early. Talking early. I like to gossip about Russia with Turkey. I also like to just sort of try and figure out what's going on in the East, because they're in a way, they're actually... Now I'm talking myself into Turkey being important to the English game at the beginning. in a way, they're actually kind of natural allies in that they don't have anything to fear from each other. They have Russia as a neighbor, and I think I read something once about how somebody looked at the statistics of a bunch of online games, and in games where England does well, Turkey does well, and in games where England does poorly, Turkey does poorly.
Right, statistically. Right. There's those stats that have been run. They do the same thing with a bunch of other countries, but I mean, it kind of makes sense
yeah,
in that particular case. It's like, oh well, weird. These countries don't actually touch each other. So you should be you want to talk to them about A. Early on, what is it that Russia's doing? What has Russia told you? B, you know, let's be friendly.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's Austria, which is, I think, is probably the most difficult one to talk to.
Yeah, actually, you may have less in common with Austria than you do with Turkey.
You do. I think Austria is the most difficult for you to talk to as England, because it's really hard. There's no incentive.
Yeah. Poor Austria is always flailing and just trying to keep everybody on the board from attacking him at that point. He couldn't care less what you're doing.
Right, he doesn't want to talk to you.
if you have days, if you're playing an online game and you just want to talk to everybody,
sure,
he's a good gossip partner also, because, like I said, you and him don't really have much to worry about. Germany is never coming after him in 01. You know, so
unless they're insane.
Unless they're insane, right. And so... He. If anything, he's probably interested in a strong Germany. So when in doubt, just tell him, "Oh yeah, I'm going to ally with Germany, and we're going to go kill France. It'll be good."
I think that's very important, though.
Yeah.
Be careful what you say to Austria if you're going to talk to him at all, because probably what Austria is going to do is, if he has time, tell that to Germany.
Yeah. Yeah. I agree. And then Italy is the last one, and you actually do have a neighbor in common with Italy that is, or occasionally. It's important that Italy is his neighbor, and that's France.
Right, and every once in a while you can roll the dice, and France will open to Piedmont.
Right, or Italy will open to Piedmont, or they'll bounce in Piedmont, or, yeah.
Something.
I mean, I think probably, unless I've, for whatever reason, really decided right away I want to be France's ally, I think I always ask Italy, have you thought about Piedmont?
Well, yeah.
Because why not stress out the French guy? The French guy's got a great position, and even if you're England, you know, maybe even if you do want to work with him, it's not terrible if your ally gets a little bit of pressure early on.
And the best allies are the allies that need a little something from you.
Yeah, it's very, very good for the English player if Italy actually just wanders into Piedmont at the beginning, because then there's so little... Oh, God, France has to make that decision about where he goes. Does he try and take Spain and risk Marseille, or does he hold? It's just awful. All right, so Italy is definitely worth talking to, especially about France, if you can get him to do some, or in fact, if you can get him to do something anti-German. That's
it's possible you can get him to do that, but it's fairly unlikely you're going to get him to open Tyrolia. Although, every once in a while... Yeah, I know.
Is Italy?
Well, I guess, what do they call that? The Alpine Chicken?
I don't know. Yeah.
Yeah, where you open up there and France supports them in Munich.
Yeah.
I guess that happens. So, given all of these, that's what you need to talk to your neighbors about.
Yeah.
And the interwoven in there is some strategies, but more specifically, just England-centric. What are you going to do? What's your strategy for the first 5 years?
Okay, good question. If You want to find an ally. That almost goes without saying. But if you can't find anybody who wants to work with you, it's probably because they're scheming against you. No matter how secure England is, a concerted France-German-Russian thing that's just made up its mind to take you out is going to do so.
It's called a sea lion.
Yeah, a sea lion. Yeah, you don't want that to happen. You offer anything if you feel like it's brewing before the beginning.
If for some reason you're out and about there, people are talking, you're newish to the game, and you keep hearing the word sea lion...
Yeah.
That's a red flag.
It's where France and Germany scheme to be in the North Sea by the end of 01 and planning on invading your island almost immediately after that.
Typically, it looks like France opening to the channel, Russia opening north, and Germany pretty much doing what he was going to do anyway, but getting that fleet into Denmark.
Yep. And there's different degrees of how serious it is. Like, France in the Channel isn't the end of the world. You can always talk him back out of there and into Belgium or something like
Especially
that.
Especially when he's there by himself.
Exactly. Some people, I think, who play England are absolutely, francicidal. And some people are absolutely Germanicidal, and I'm not either, really.
No.
It's going to depend on the player. I guess... I would focus on getting armies onto the continent somewhere.
Right.
Armies, specifically. Like, England is a fleet power, needs to be a fleet power. He has to control the seas, especially the North Sea. He should probably never leave it for the whole game, other than in desperate circumstances. But that's only half the battle. You know, controlling those seas up there that he's surrounded by are important, but... getting armies to where they can do good. If you're thinking about winning this game, if you actually plan on soloing, it's all about the armies. It's just all about them. Like, build as many as you can, as quick as you can, and put them to as good a use as you can, getting farther and farther and farther away from your oceans, because it's the only way.
Right, what you're doing with those fleets, and especially immediately around your country, is you're making little freeways for those armies to get off.
Yeah.
And they... one of the biggest weaknesses that England has early on is the fact that he has a piece on the island that needs to get off. And he's in an immediate disadvantage where other powers are able to concentrate three pieces at a specific geographical area.
Yep.
England can't do that.
No.
So you need to find a path to get on the island. Typically what people do is they start with the Norway and they put an army there because it's easy.
Yeah.
Some people like that.
And it's okay, but it's actually pretty... like, an experienced Russia is going to take that as really, really hostile.
I totally agree. I don't do it.
When I'm Russia, I'm going to say, look, I know you're going to take Norway, but please go, you know, open to the Norwegian Sea and then go from the Norwegian Sea with your fleet down to Norway, because that's, you know, sure, it still borders St. Petersburg, but it's not like you can put two things on St. Petersburg extremely easily come 1902. And in any event, I would always, as England, if I feel like one of my continental allies, France or Germany, wants to let me put an army down on the continent, I'd always favor that. I'd always prefer that my army ends up down there. No matter who my enemy is.
And you're going to figure this out pretty quick when you're in your extended 1901 discussions that someone's going to want to work with you. Yeah. I mean, we're just assuming this scenario, someone wants to work with you.
Yeah.
If no one wants to work with you and no one will make any commitment, also a red flag.
Yeah.
But probably one or the other of France or Germany is going to want to say, hey, let's do this thing. And that's your opportunity to say, I'd like to put an army there.
Yeah.
Because you need to find a way to do that.
I'm looking forward to what Chris has to say about this, where he wants that army if it were up to him. I mean, I suppose the obvious answer is Belgium.
That's where I want my army.
Yeah, definitely. Because you can sell it to either France or Germany. You can say, like, sometimes they'll both give it to you. Sometimes they'll both write a support if you did it well.
You know what the most beautiful thing is?
Yeah.
Is Army London to Belgium, supported by Burgundy and Holland.
Right, exactly.
I love that.
Where the German and the Frenchman, you've convinced them both that as soon as that army gets down there, it's there to help them against the other one. And
beautiful.
You might be telling them both the truth, for all you know. And then if you do that and pick up Norway also, then you'd better be building another army at that point. because now you've had the England opening that you're looking for.
Right. So let's talk about some specific openings.
All right. Openings.
That work well. And actually, you know what I'd like to start is what doesn't work, and then we get into the really typical stuff. What shouldn't you do?
Okay. I would say that 100% of good English openings involve something going to the North Sea. Okay. I know it sounds obvious, but I suppose there could be some reason that someone might have decided to go to the English Channel with one of their fleets, but then the Norwegian with their other.
There's a reason. It's called greed.
Well, but it doesn't really make it any safer for you getting Norway, because the only thing that's going to oppose you getting Norway in the fall is a Russian unit that moves north.
Right, but you want to do it with an army. And you open to Edinburgh.
Yeah. All right, I've never done it. put it that way. The North.
I have.
Awesome. Yeah. Nathan with his awesome war stories about all the awesome things he said. No, it didn't work out well.
I wasn't trying to imply that.
I was just saying
it was greedy.
I can understand doing it and being really proud of yourself when it works out. Most of the time, the North Sea is going to be your most important space. It borders everything. It borders everything important that's yours. It also borders everything. It borders how many dots? I don't know.
I'm looking at the board right now. Four, five, six, seven.
Yeah, and two of them are yours at the beginning, and the other five can be your targets. Really, reason. So the North Sea is an obvious one. And so the main question is, do you go Edinburgh to the North Sea and then plan on going London to the English Channel, or do you go London to the North Sea and then Edinburgh to the Norwegian Sea? Those are, I'd say, 97% of English openings involve one of those two combinations. And so I guess let's talk about both of them. If you're going Edinburgh to the North Sea, and we'll work the army in there too, don't worry, but let's just start with the fleets, because that's your big decision that you have as England. If you're going Edinburgh to the North Sea, London to the English Channel, why are you doing this?
Well, if you were asking me...
I'm asking you.
Well, I think the best... That's probably the strongest way to do it. I mean, you're bordering the maximum number of dots.
Mm-hmm. That's true.
You're probably pissing off the few amount of people possible. And this is why I was kind of hesitating when you talk about the army. If you're going to open this way, the only way it really... Well, unless...
Wait,
you,
which one are we talking about here? Channel
North Sea.
Okay.
If you open Channel North Sea...
So you think that one pisses off the least amount of people possible?
No, yeah. But the ratio between the number of dots you border to the amount of anger you engender is really based on where you put that army. If you put that army in Wales...
We'll call that the Nathan factor.
Yeah, no, that's a terrible thing.
The amount of people pissed off by... divided by... No, go on.
Yeah, it's important. It's all like right. Einstein's... Whatever.
Right.
Something. There's some sort of constant out there. Like, right. But you need to be able to border the maximum number of dots by not pissing off that many people.
Yep.
You don't want that reaction. So opening that army to Wales at the same time is probably a really terrible idea, unless... You've really got a solid Germany on board, and you're just going to wipe out France.
Yeah, I've had that.
Italy helps.
I probably had that done to me more times than I've done that. But I've been France and just been facing a homicidal anti-French England, where they just want the North Sea. They want to do everything they can to you and just march down your thing or die trying.
I've been there.
It can work.
It can.
Yeah, I don't
it's a lot that. Harder if you don't have some friends.
Yeah.
Like, if Italy's not in Piedmont and Germany's not banging on your door,
yeah.
England keep knocking.
Yeah, but you can really be left hanging doing it that way, too.
It destroys your game.
At this point, you only have a limited chance of actually getting Norway, which is your one... guaranteed build, quote unquote. It's not guaranteed, but it's the one that most Englands get first, and it's the one that everyone on the board sort of seems to feel that he's entitled to.
Right, every power has a dot or two that they are entitled to.
But then again, you have a lot more strength on Belgium, and hey, you could get Brest. You never know.
That it's true. It's a strong opening, but if you want to play it safe and you're not sure what to do, you can't read your neighbors.
Mm-hmm.
The easy thing to do, Norwegian, north.
Right.
Put that army in either, well, you can put it in Yorkshire or
Yorkshire or Edinburgh. Those are your choices.
Edinburgh will send a signal to the Russians that make them a little nervous, but
which
might be fine.
There's a technical reason that that's the case, and it's, I don't know. If you go Yorkshire to Edinburgh,
it's Liverpool is a center. You're thinking.
Sorry. Liverpool to Edinburgh, Edinburgh to the Norwegian Sea, London to the North Sea. See, yeah, I misorder all the time. You guys, if you listen to a lot of this show, you're going to learn that I'm going to say the wrong thing, and I probably will also write the wrong thing.
I really think it's my extra 2 years of experience.
Oh, is
really,
that what it is? Yeah. Okay, all right. You go London to the North Sea, Edinburgh to the Norwegian Sea, Liverpool to Edinburgh. What you're doing is you're putting the maximum amount of pressure so that you could, if you needed to, make a supported attack on Norway with the convoy to make sure that your army gets up there. So it's maximally, I've got to get Norway and I don't care about anything right. else, which a Russian will take as anti-Russian. But if you do it knowing that you have an anti-English Russian already, then it actually is your best move.
Right. It's the safest, it's the absolute safest move opening that you can do. If you think everyone hates you, that's how you open.
Yeah. In practice, don't worry so much about it, because you're probably just going to get Norway anyway. But if it's just absolute war between you and the Russian at the very beginning, then that's okay. An okay opening. Let's see. So, if you've managed to end up, oh, I was looking at the part. Yeah, all right. I guess I have to make an edit here or something. London in the North Sea, Edinburgh to the Norwegian Sea, and Liverpool to Yorkshire gives you the option of convoying down to Belgium, which. The other one does too.
Yeah, they're equally good with that. The reason you do the big reason for the Edinburgh move is that you can convoy with either.
Right.
Which is strong.
Right.
Like, you can still convoy to Norway and drop down to Belgium, or you can convoy into Belgium and pick up Norway. It just maximizes the things that you can do.
Generally speaking, I think it's much better to make the North Sea your convoyer, no matter which direction you've gone, toward France or up north, because then you get to stay in the North Sea.
Unless you're greedy.
Unless you're greedy. Right. I mean, I've been greedy, gotten those two, and realized, oh, I'm building two, but I'm not in the North Sea anymore. And it's kind of a drag. It's kind of.
It can be.
Yeah.
It depends on your neighbors.
Then you have to fight to get it back again, and your pieces are all kind of isolated from each other at that point. So, something to consider if you're thinking about anything where you're going for two in your first season. And by the way, I'd say 75% of the games I play, England only gets one.
Oh, yeah. Getting two as England is aspirational.
Usually Norway. It's occasionally Belgium. Getting both is great if you can. But I would say, generally speaking, most of the games they don't. But you just should be planning on trying to get two.
Right.
You're never going to get three. There's no such thing as a three-goal English opening. Damn it.
It's impossible.
It's just not fair. But there's no way to do it. So you're either going to get 0, 1, or 2. And zero, and you're pretty much done. Unless you're Chris Martin.
Well, we'll have to hear what he says about that.
Yeah.
So let's say you've done one of the two openings we've described to you. Entirely dependent on your negotiations.
Yep.
You've gone with the optimal one. For whatever reason, the strength of England has gone with you.
Yep.
And you have that benefit of a little bit of isolation, and it's mm-hmm. the mid-game.
Mm-hmm. So, if you've made it to the mid-game, it's because you found an ally. I think that's safe to say. Or the people that are attacking you are so incredibly incompetent that you're still hanging out there at 2 or 3 and sticking your tongue out at them. But
actually, let's take a moment and talk
sure.
about that.
Sure.
Because is it possible, do you think, to get to the mid-game, let's say 1906... Well,
06, 04 maybe.
04 to 06. Yeah. Let's say is it possible to get there without an ally and be in a position where you're viable?
I mean, sure. You can hang around, be getting attacked And not really give any ground just by maneuvering and being good at tactics and just sort of owning a difficult part of the board to take. You have to get a little bit lucky. It helps a lot if the people that are attacking you are getting attacked from the other direction themselves, sure. Which is what you should be motivated to do almost exclusively. If France, Germany just decide, let's go kill England at the very beginning of the game, your number one priority is to get the East to go kill France, Germany, which they'll do if you promise them the world and whatnot. And you can, as England, have that bad start. Probably more than, I'd say, yeah, probably more than just about any other country. You can have that bad start and just sort of float around and have two of your home centers plus Norway, two of your home centers plus Portugal, one of your home centers, and this and that, and then something bad happens to the people that are trying to kill you, and the next thing you know, yeah, okay, I'm reconstituting. I've got some of my island back. I got London back. I got Liverpool back. You can make it to the mid game without an ally, I'd say. Do you agree? Okay.
No, I think I largely agree. I
certainly remember one game where you did that, and we were both in the draw. you were like the 3-dot England for the entire game,
right?
And I was in Austria or something, and the next thing I knew, I was like, hey, it's Nathan, and he's at 8, and we win. Hooray for us.
How did that happen? No, yeah. I think you really aptly put it when you said that you can have two at home, you can lose a home center, have something somewhere else, and legitimately recover, which yeah. I have to agree. England is probably one of the few countries where that happens.
Yeah.
Russia's the only one that comes to mind that's similar.
Yeah.
But they have four.
Yeah. And, right? and by the time they've reconstituted, a lot of times they're all armies and it's boring and they end up being like a small part. Whereas England can actually reconstitute and be very dynamic.
So that's another strength of England. Like
yeah.
really
They've always got fleets, and fleets are more dynamic. They go farther, or anyway, it seems like they go farther. They tend to, like the North Sea, but what did we just say? It borders 7 dots, right? There's always somewhere to retreat if you're getting bashed, and a lot of times it's a dot. It's hard to not own anything as long as you're concentrating around the North Sea.
I don't know if Kalhammer was really into Churchill or something, but you really get that feeling, like, there's a guy, like, you'll stall my beaches,
right.
It's exactly like that.
Right, exactly.
But let's say, we're at the mid-game, right?
Yeah, so we're saying, yes, you can probably just sort of hang out there and tough it out and never go beyond 4. But let's say that you've actually been doing well. We're going to assume you found an ally at this point. You've either got, like, a good solid EF or a good solid EG going. So where you're working with France, or you're working with Germany at this point. The West, I would say, goes kind of the same every time. This is a gross...
Well, let's hear about this. Let's hear how it goes the same way.
Two guys beat up one guy, and then they realize they have to beat up each other. It is my gross overgeneralization here.
You think that's true?
Well, no, but...
just as typically, it really seems like the two theaters race to figure out what the alliances are.
Yeah.
If you're in the West and you're lucky, there's two alliances on the other side and they don't go anywhere and you
right.
can resolve your side before something happens.
Right.
But more typically, Italy does nothing, Austria collapses, or maybe Turkey collapses as a collaborated effort, and you got a three-way versus, an EF or an EG or an FG.
Yep.
So, I don't know if it's that typical. I don't want to, stomp on you a little bit.
No.
But I do think what the immediate goal of your it's like playing a game of poker. Are you the mark? You just figure out who the guy is you're going to kill. That's the West.
Because let's say it is my typical, overgeneralized, typical game, and the EF has gone and beat up Germany. One of you, unless you were really, really careful, one of you benefited disproportionately from that.
Oh, absolutely.
And Germany might still have a dot or two, and he might be madder at one of you than the other one of you. And so at that point, it becomes the who's going to stab whom first. Anyway, anywhere in the West, really. But if you're England, you have a bonus advantage that your back is to the wall, where their back is to nobody in particular, generally.
Right. It is a little bit nicer. And I actually think, and maybe you disagree, I actually think England ends up on top of things a little bit more than frequently. France does.
Well,
simply because they have that wall there that they're typically battling, that continental wall that Germany's thrown up.
And the trade-off is France might have gotten more dots because he's closer to them than you are. So you've got the safer position, but France might be bigger at that point.
Depends.
An EG, you almost definitely have the upper hand, I think. Because in an EG, everything that I just said is probably also true, in that, like, Germany might be bigger than you, but you've got the more secure position. But with an EG, you've got the way more secure position. You've taken out France, and now what? I mean, is he going to come after you all the way through those oceans? He can. Sometimes it happens. But more often than not, he's your front line. Okay, we've done it. We've gone ahead. We've taken out France. Now I'm behind you. Now let's go forward to the east. That almost can never be good for Germany.
This probably isn't a good time to mention this, but I do find it very interesting that I'm an EF fan and you're an EG fan, especially the way you just characterized it. Very interesting to me.
We're going to take a break, folks.
I think it's very interesting.
So if you're playing Germany at a tournament, and I say, let's be allies.
No.
Yeah, well.
I don't want to drift off topic. We were talking about mid-game strategy. What is it that optimally England should be doing? Is it just going back to the opening strategy of find ways to pump armies onto the continent? Is there anything else that should be...
Some direction. I mean, obviously, you're going to need a second target at some point. You know, and that second target could be the other guy that you weren't working with. You can always just backstab the guy that you were working with and try and take the whole West. Or your second target could be, basically Russia or Italy at that point. Because you've probably been at least skirmishing a little bit with Russia already.
Absolutely.
No matter what's happening. It's a rare and kind of wonderful game, actually, when England and Russia just go, let's stay out of each other's way. And then they really do stay out of each other's way.
That
it's
whole
good
northern
for both.
Sort of like, you know, just pressing downward sort of thing works pretty well.
It's good for both. And that's actually sort of always what I try and do diplomatically especially when I'm England, I think. But it's at some point that's going to break down, because maybe the place that you really want to rush to in the mid game is, you know, you want to start working on Moscow and Warsaw and you know, having taken Scandinavia or whatever. The other alternative, if you're not going to attack your other ally in the West, is be swarming into the Mediterranean, right?
Italy loves.
Yeah.
Well,
I'm saying let's say you've actually either you're swarming into the Mediterranean with your French ally, or you're swarming into the Mediterranean because you've already killed and replaced France,
right,
like a pod person, and now they're dark blue fleets swarming into the Mediterranean.
Sort of that aquamarine hue.
Yeah, yeah. And either one, it's basically the same. You want to get something out there.
Well, you're going to do part
Tunis
of that
or
anyway.
Rome or somewhere far away like that, yeah.
Because the Mediterranean is the first part of that stalemate line that you're going to want to secure.
Mm-hmm.
You want to make sure you have that Mao, North Atlantic, English Channel sort of lock to protect yourself, especially if you're in that EG. And if you're in the FG, you're going to want it just in case, in collaboration with your ally, just in case the East gets their act together and starts coming through the Med.
Right. Right, yeah, you can't let them get over. So, obviously, it's harder to talk about the mid-game whenever you're talking about diplomacy, because so much could be the case.
Could be.
And a lot of it is just going to be you reacting to what you think your openings are. But I'd say, generally, in the mid-game, you're either stabbing your ally in the West, trying to go over the top in the North, or trying to go into the Med.
And in all cases, you're trying to get armies on the continent.
Right.
I think that's really key.
Yeah. Yeah. The farther you can be convoying them, the deeper in that they can get. Like, let's say you worked with France and went and killed Germany. Like, the number one thing that I would want by the mid-game is Berlin and maybe even Munich.
Yeah, just get them in there.
Because penetrating deep into the continent it's the only way you're going to solo. England, you might end up with 6, 7, 8 fleets if you get big as England, but you're probably not going to solo with those, you know, maybe, but that's the tops. The rest have got to be armies. And every, I guarantee you, when you're playing England, if you're doing well, every turn, when you get a build, you're going to just start writing fleet. Like, because you always feel like you want them. You're just you can always use them. Wouldn't it be nice if I was in the Mid-Atlantic and the English Channel and the North Sea and the Norwegian Sea and the, you know, whatever other sea zones that it would be nice to occupy. Plus, I can be working on Belgium and this and that. But the best as you can is England. Resist the temptation. Because the armies, the only way you're going to solo, the only way you're going to get to 18 is you have to get places that only armies can go.
I like that strategy, Eric, and I think it's probably a good one, but I think maybe we should bring in an expert on this one.
Yeah, we have a really awesome guest today, and he's a person that I've always admired and really enjoyed having conversations with because he really thinks about soloing a lot and how to approach getting to that solo. So it seems to me that you'd rather hear him talk about how to solo with England than us.
Well, and you'll have plenty of opportunity to hear how well we think at other future casts. And this is also someone I have to say, every time he's on a board, I'm definitely on notice and on my best game.
Right. So anyway, without further ado, we're going to take you to our next segment where we interview Chris Martin. Joining us now, one of the winningest diplomacy players over the last decade and a half. He's won pretty much every tournament you can think of, including a World DIPCON in 1998, a North American DIPCON in 99. He's been a Grand Prix winner, a Grand Prix runner-up.
Yeah, he's done just about everything. It's kind of ridiculous. 56 tournaments. He's a great guy to be around. He's our expert today. And I just wanted to just dive right in, Chris, if you're ready. How do we solo with England? What do we do?
Okay. The first thing that you want to do is live through 1902. Ooh. Because if you don't do that, you can't solo.
You know, that's really good. We hadn't thought of that.
Yeah, that's pretty much all I have. Thanks for joining us, Chris.
Sure. Okay. I also think that 18 centers need to be involved at some point.
Yes.
This is why I knew we needed an expert.
Between those two things, I think, that make England a challenge.
Absolutely. I couldn't agree more. I'm really excited you're here. I'm glad you wrote that whole article about it.
Yeah. This is the kind of killer insight that we were looking forward to. Really, thanks for that.
No, really, seriously. What is it for you? I mean, we talked a little bit earlier about, do you go over the top? Do you focus on the med? I mean, is it best to dump a bunch of armies right on the continent right away? I mean, what do you think works?
Well, I think purely from a tactical point of view that the importance of getting armies onto mainland Europe can't be overstated. Mm-hmm. But when it actually comes to getting solos in diplomacy, I think that something David Hood said to me once has sort of been the thing which I've always looked at. And that is that everybody on the board pretty much has to agree that a solo is the right result.
And it's interesting.
England, more than any other power, maybe, England is hard to force solos.
Right.
You can do it if you get enough, you know, momentum build. But it's also really easy to get stuffed as England.
Right.
Lots of mediocre Englands end on anywhere between 6 and 10 centers.
Yeah.
Very safe, very easy, and like I say, very mediocre.
Yeah, we said earlier that it's, compared to other powers, it's relatively easy to get to 12 or 13 or 14, but relatively difficult to get to 18.
Right.
Yeah.
Like Turkey, you've got to get, you know, into the other guy's heartland. Mm-hmm. And that usually means Tunis or Moscow or Venice or Vienna.
Right.
Or other centers that are just improbably far away from England.
Right.
Of those,
right.
I think Moscow and Tunis are the closest, right? And if you just look at spaces on the board.
So what you're saying then is you kind of have to plan ahead, like more than with other countries. Would you agree with that?
I think that you have to always have your eye on the prize.
Right.
Yeah?
Mm-hmm.
So you can't, I think planning ahead is important, but you can't go into the game. I talk to a lot of newer players who think that opening strategy connects seamlessly with endgame strategy.
Right.
And I don't think that's true. I think that what happens in the rest of the board really helps you understand where you should put your forces in order to get across the lines.
Well, it's, I didn't mean to interrupt, Chris, but you said earlier that, you know, you'd gotten a piece of advice that said, you know, a solo needs to be the result that the board wants. I mean, is there anything, is that a strategy that you employ every game? Is there something about England that you do to sort of get yourself in that position?
Well, the thing that it needs to happen then is usually it becomes there's acrimony on the board that doesn't involve you.
Yep.
Right? That you're the beneficiary of.
Yep.
Or what we here on the East Coast like to call the Bartoloni effect.
I see.
Right?
Right, somebody, we'll have to explain that to people later.
Yeah, we'll have him on the show to explain himself.
Somebody gets so upset at somebody else that they don't care anymore if you get their dots.
Yep.
And this happened to me, I think, just a couple of years ago at a tournament. And I was England, and I want to say Rick Desper was either France or Germany. Can't remember.
Mm-hmm.
And we were working together, and the other side of the board kind of had him stuffed.
Yep.
And I was kind of tootling along and picking up games where I could in the north. And they were like, Rick, you have to go fight Chris.
Yep.
And they took a center from him. And they were like, Rick, you have to go fight Chris. And they took another center from him. And he said, you know what? He can have all my centers.
Uh-huh.
That led to me winning.
Yeah. Yeah. So, I think that's something that is not just for England, but it applies generally as a diplomacy philosophy. Most solos, at least most tournament solos, have to be, I don't want to say thrown, but there has to be a couple of people on the board who are kind of okay with it.
Right? People have to agree. Because if you get, all it takes is really one person on the other side of the board who really cares and has enough goodwill from the other players to rally a defense.
Right.
You know? And then you start getting looking at tactics.
Right.
And how do you force stalemate lines? And I think that's something that English players maybe don't pay enough attention to. Is where are the stalemate lines? How do you hold them? How do you get across them?
Yeah.
Maybe we can talk a little bit more about that.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, one big thing I think is there's England and I suppose Turkey on the other side are the most vulnerable to that big fat line that runs right down the middle of the board. Yeah. That's the one that gives them the most trouble getting across. So.
Yep.
So that, yeah, that Moscow, not Moscow, St. Petersburg, mid-Atlantic line. Yeah, I think I'm going to assume a lot of people are aware of that line. What else? What other lines do you think are pretty important for England?
Well, I think that the most important one is the one at Gibraltar.
Right.
And if you can get fleets to the other side of Gibraltar in enough force that you can kind of maintain an outpost there, those are likely going to be your 17th and 18th dots over there. So even if you can get them first, you know, so much the better. A lot of times I'll see good players as England bypass French centers, right?
Yeah.
Bypass Iberian centers to get those fleets around and into the Med.
Right.
So that you can eventually have the opportunity to take, whether it's Tunis or Naples or whatever it's going to be, and hold off whoever the other naval power over there is, usually Turkey.
Exactly.
And other than Gibraltar, is there? I'm trying to think of the center. Is it?
Well,
when you are playing, are you aiming for Munich or are you aiming for Tunis? This is a debate we were having earlier.
Ah,
I mean, you were playing it,
right?
What's your focus?
Well, the interesting thing is that I kind of see it as a sort of a branching tree of opportunity, right?
Yeah.
And if you work with Germany against France, that opportunity tends to point towards Tunis.
Yeah.
And conversely, tends to point towards Munich. But the problem, and this is where I think most Englands fall down, is you can't work with France or Germany and get to 18 reasonably.
Ooh, that's interesting. That's a good, you really, yeah.
Because they have the dots you need.
Yeah, they do.
Right?
They do. So anybody working with an England needs to be aware of the fact that he absolutely needs you if he plans on winning.
Right.
Yeah.
But what that does is that introduces a lot of tension into the alliance, which is really productive for the non-English players, right?
Yeah,
exactly.
It also balances out the sort of inherent advantages to that sort of elephant-whale alliance where one person has all the armies, one person has all the fleets, right?
Right.
And that's where a lot of England's fall down, again, is they get the coastal centers, right?
Yeah.
St. Petersburg and three Scandinavian, and that puts them at 7. And they get Belgium and Holland, and that puts them at 9. Mm-hmm. They get Brest and Spain and Portugal, and that puts them at 12. And that's all they're going to get unless they take Kiel and, you know, Berlin eventually to put them at 14.
Right.
But then they're home stretching right there. They're straining to get those last two dots. They haven't even gotten close to not even the orbit of 18 yet, and they're already struggling.
And, you know, being at 14 and nowhere close to a solo.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, not good.
One of the unusual things that you can do as a player.
I mean, obviously, depending on your scoring system, that might turn out to be a very good result at a tournament.
Oh, sure.
But obviously, we're talking about soloing here. That's what we're interested in knowing. So you would say then that you kind of need to stick with one of those guys and sort of surround him and be getting your stuff further out and then maybe come back for your ally stuff that you need. Am I saying that?
What ends up working out a lot, I see, is that in that alliance, in any alliance, right, what you want to do is you want to be the partner who succeeds because of your opponent's incompetence, not okay. because of treachery.
Yeah, you're waiting for the opportunities like, well, you messed up.
Not even the partner's incompetence, right? But like if you and France are beating on Germany and you're constant, and at the same time, Russia falls apart.
Uh-huh.
Right, and you're able to wheel in and turn the corner and bring armies around through Prussia and Silesia to
the
German centers, well, then it's going to be a lot easier for you to negotiate managing something like Vienna, you know, at the end of the game.
Right.
And then having stuff in position, armies in place to fight with France over essentially Paris, right?
Right.
Once he starts committing fleets to the Med.
So if you plan on soloing as England, get the farther stuff first and then come back for the closer stuff.
Once you've secured the threats to your home island.
Yeah.
Yes.
Oh, okay. Starting with the mid game, I guess is how I should have said that. Okay.
But, and here's the thing. Here's the other mistake that I think a lot of England's make. I really believe that St. Petersburg is a dead end for England.
I couldn't it's actually a strong proponent of that. I totally agree.
Yeah, England goes to St. Petersburg to be irrelevant in the game.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. It is a debt. It's a cul-de-sac.
Even if you manage to get two armies over there, right?
Yep.
Which you are supporting. You have your initial army, and you built another one when you took St. Petersburg, right? So you're at 5, right? Owning Norway, St. Pete at home.
Yep.
You commit enough force to maybe, with Turkish help, take Moscow. There's no way you can hold it at that point of the game.
Right. Right.
Too much. It's too far away. You don't have enough influence over the other geopolitics, right? And a competent France, Germany, is going to come running up your pipe.
So you'd prefer to be involved down on the continent much earlier, most of the time.
All day. Yeah.
Okay.
And it sounds like we're going this direction anyway. Is there any other pitfalls that we should be avoiding? I mean, we can get off the soloing thing a little bit, but
sure.
you've mentioned a couple of things. One. You know, England's fall apart by focusing too much on the coastals, and England runs into a dead end if they start trucking stuff up into St. Petersburg too early. Are there other pitfalls some we should be avoiding?
Well, so you listen to all of this, and you've read all the strategy, and you think, okay, I'm going to negotiate to get an army into Belgium in 1901.
Right.
Right? Belgium is where English armies go to die in 1902. Right? As both Germany and France decide that killing that army is the thing, one thing that they can agree on.
Yeah, well, unless it was invited there.
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
Even when they've invited it there, right?
Mm-hmm.
So you really have to have a firm idea for where you're going to go with that army.
Right.
Once you've landed it there.
Right.
Too many people get Norway and get Belgium and build something useless like Fleet London, Fleet Edinburgh, right?
Yeah.
Because if you're going after France, you need to build Fleet Liverpool and Fleet London, right, so that you can lock down the Mid-Atlantic Ocean.
Sure.
If you're going after Germany, you need another army.
Yeah, and maybe even if you're going after France, if you're building two, another army isn't terrible.
Not bad at all. Yeah. It really depends on the French sort of position and whether or not they see it coming.
Yeah.
Well, and depending on how duplicitous you're trying to be, I mean, the Fleet Liverpool really says, you know, maybe you're telling your German ally, this is, I'm going. Maybe you haven't decided which way you're going yet. And
that's one of the things you have to finesse, but that's a good way for your army to die in Belgium, I think, is to try and keep playing both ends against the middle for too long there.
Yeah, I agree.
Because ultimately you got to get tucked in and kill somebody.
Yeah, and every season you wait, that's a season you're just going to be struggling at 14.
That's a season you're inviting Austria or Russia or Turkey to get their act together and get a force in place that you can't deal with except by proxy.
Right.
And then you have to not stab the person who is on the dots that you want because they're holding the units that are preventing the other side of the board from winning.
Exactly. On the pitfalls note, you mentioned to me in an email correspondence a couple of days ago that you saw a bad England in a recent game that you played. An England that really...
It was more of a mediocre England.
A mediocre England.
don't want to disparage anyone. You just want to clearly label it as mediocre. That's great.
Yeah. Yeah. We are diplomats after all. Why don't you go ahead.
So one of the things that I believe in diplomacy is that if you bring force to a point, usually someone else will too.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas if you can negotiate settlements that involve fewer units, that you can like have a peaceful front behind you. I mean, that's the ideal, right? Is you have, but you're always going to have more than one front with diplomacy. One you want to solve with your military, one you want to solve with your diplomacy.
All the rest you want to solve with your diplomacy, if possible.
Yeah, exactly.
Right.
Possible. Awesome. So this England was fixated on the fact that I was Russia, and
that sounds very familiar.
Yeah, not an unreasonable thing, but okay.
Not an unreasonable proposition, but never didn't do one of the two things that I think are then reasonable, right? Either come over with a big enough stick to take St. Petersburg,
mm-hmm.
right? Which England can certainly do, mm-hmm. right?
Sure.
Or negotiate a settlement that he could live with.
Right. Right.
And that I could live with, right? Instead, what he did is he locked down Norway without ever going to the Barents.
Oh, in other words, he put like two units whose job it was to just protect Norway, or three units, yeah.
He convoyed the army over.
Yeah.
Right?
And double supported.
Then I walked into Romania unexpectedly and built two armies, Army St. Petersburg, Army Sev, as it happened.
Right.
And he was like, "Oh, Army St. Petersburg, you're coming after me."
Right.
And I was like, "Yeah, because it's an amphibious army. Cross the North Sea by itself." So, you know, he supported himself to hold, brought another fleet into the North Sea, and then proceeded to spend the next 4 years making sure he didn't lose Norway.
Right. Ouch. Right. So,
to France's delight, right?
Mm-hmm.
As he supported France, as France, frankly, just flat out took Belgium from him.
Yeah.
Right? And Germany is like, going, "Why won't you do anything?" And France, you know.
Because I only have one unit with which to do anything.
Like, England was like, "The minute I take my eye off of that guy in Russia, I'm going to be in trouble."
Yeah. Okay, yeah.
Not realizing he was already in trouble.
He was already in trouble. France never attacked him. France never really had a good chance to attack him. Germany never attacked him. Germany never really had a good chance to attack him. He did end up, at the end of the game, having Sweden and Denmark.
Mm-hmm.
But that's a lot of gameplay to end up with two more dots.
Yeah.
What year was it?
1906.
Wow.
Yeah. It's a good general point to make that, for people listening, playing defense, I'm trying to
there's
think
a time
it.
For it.
Yeah.
But there's, you gotta grow.
Yeah. You have to be thinking, where is my next dot coming from? Not what a catastrophe will it be if I lose one of my current dots.
And even if you don't have the where's my next dot mentality, you can also have the where is it that I need to be next year. I mean, sometimes you're just not gonna grow, you know, maybe but having a posture that you're only, you're sitting for 4 years guarding a neutral center while your opponents are growing.
Right. Yeah. Ends up in Tunis.
Right.
We see a lot of newer players that kind of get a couple of neutrals, you know, maybe get to 5 or 6, and then they don't have a plan after that. All they want to do is just make sure they don't lose what they have, and then if and when, and inevitably someone does come attacking them, they kind of stop talking to anyone. They kind of stop negotiating and spend all of their time just trying to figure out how to lose the least. And
yeah, and sometimes it just feels like maybe you just Yorkshire pudding it. Maybe that's just how you should just open your game and just stay that way.
Yeah, all right. We have to ask about it. We have to, the Yorkshire pudding opening. First of all, what is the Yorkshire pudding opening?
It's when you send all three of your units as England to Yorkshire in spring of 1901.
Ah, I see.
That's guaranteeing that you will not have a build
at
the end of the year.
And that none of your pieces move.
So all your centers are covered.
And I had heard a rumor that you've actually employed this.
I did, in fact, use this at the Carnage on the Lake tournament this last year.
Why would a person use this particular opening?
Why?
Yeah. I had seen it used once before. And it was by Jan Kluwe. So there was some, perhaps some sense that I had to demonstrate that I had the same kind of chops as Jan, who was a master of the game.
You were in some sort of, like, chutzpah competition with him?
I'm not saying that there was a ruler involved, but it
was. you employed the opening.
So I employed this opening, and here was the situation. A lot of it was personalities. I'd been looking for a place to do this for literally a couple of years.
Yeah, no, I remember having conversations with you about how it was your dream to use the Yorkshire pudding opening about, like,
it seems like
when we both still lived in New York, whatever that was.
Oh, God,
so
more than that, though.
Well, yeah.
It's just so it really says to the rest of the border two things, right? I think it sends one really obvious message, right? The first message it says is you don't have to worry about me being a threat to you in the immediate future. Right? And the less obvious message I think it sends is, I am so confident in my game that I do not have to be an immediate threat to you to be dangerous.
Yeah.
And that doesn't invoke some sort of reaction from other people like, what, you're so cocky, I have to, like, come after you. That's not what happens.
It was so funny. In this instance, it was nobody noticed that I had done that. My opening went entirely unremarked. I couldn't believe it. You know, it's one of those things where you know you're going to get up at the karaoke bar and you're going to sing Sex Bomb and everyone's going to talk about it?
Yeah.
And it goes, that was nice. Good work. I've never sung a note in my life. So literally, it was a personality thing. There were some newer players. There was a guy who played diplomacy, 15, 20 years ago. And John Hill in France, who was like, yeah, okay, good. You didn't go to the channel.
I didn't go anywhere.
I didn't go anywhere, yeah. Go to the channel now, bitch. and you know what? Interestingly, it worked really well.
I was going to say, how'd you wind up in the game?
I ended up topping the board.
To be clear, though, this is an advanced opening.
Yeah.
Right? Maybe this doesn't work for everybody.
Yeah.
Maybe it doesn't work for everybody. Yeah, if I had to say to new players, you should probably be opening. You should be familiar with, opening to the channel so that you're planning on convoying the army in the fall. Opening the channel so that you can still send the army over to Norway. Right? And you should know what the difference is between those two openings.
In other words, the army goes to Wales or the army goes to Yorkshire.
And you should be aware of the difference between opening to Eddy and opening to Yorkshire if you send both fleets towards Scandinavia.
Yeah, we covered that some. We didn't talk too much about moving the army to Wales versus Yorkshire in a channel opening. That's a good point.
Yeah.
What's your preference? Are you a channel guy? Are you a non-channel guy? Or?
Well, it turns out I kind of tongue-in-cheek wrote an article once
that
suggested that England should open to the channel more often. As a result, I've been obligated to open to the channel a lot more often.
Right.
And be bounced there, right? Which
Whoops.
I think at the end, well, yeah, you know. France tends to benefit from England getting preoccupied in Scandinavia, disproportionately.
Yeah.
On the other hand, France suffers less from a bounce in the English Channel than England does.
Yeah, I agree with that. I mean, it's really bad for both, but...
It is.
Yeah.
Worse for England?
Yeah.
Except for this. Because what happens in the fall? In the fall, you go to the Channel again. And right. If France doesn't, you're in the Channel.
That's true.
Not so bad.
That's right? True.
You know, he's in the Mid-Atlantic Ocean. And if he isn't in the Channel, right, if he bounces you, he can't build a fleet in Brest.
No, it's absolutely.
Right?
Yeah.
So you can, if you decide, fine, we're at war, you can slap down a fleet in Liverpool.
Yep.
And then, you know, fight it out over the Mid-Atlantic Ocean to Germany's great cackling laughter, no doubt.
Well, and I think what's interesting about that and why I don't think that plays out that often is that it's just, I think, raw greed on the part of the French. I mean, there's so much low-hanging fruit there, and it's really yep. hard to resist. Yep. So I don't know what – I mean, France almost never opens to the Channel. I mean, it just doesn't happen.
Yeah.
Unless they believe that England is going there.
Well, right? Absolutely, and it takes some convincing because they want to believe England's not going there.
Yeah, because there's so many – their game is so much better, I think, if they don't have a problem. Which is really why I suggested that England should do it more often, to keep France honest.
Yeah, right.
One of the best tournament games I ever had was as England, opening to the Channel, convoying to Brest, building another army, convoying to Picardy, forcing Paris, 1902, right?
Uh-huh. I've had that done to me.
Were we in the same board?
No.
No. I think France was, I can see him in my mind, European player who...
We'll call him European dead guy for purposes
European,
of this.
European, quality European player.
Yeah, yeah.
And he just was like, you're not going to stop, are you? And I was like, there's no percentage in it.
Yep.
And, you know, and I ended up with all of France. And Germany was like, wow, I usually get some of that.
Like, not this time, sorry.
Yep, not this time.
All right, God, I would sit and talk English openings for another hour if we had time, but we probably better move on here.
Let's get to know Chris a little. Let's who is this guy?
I like long beaches.
Mm-hmm.
I don't like to walk on them. I just like long beaches.
You just like that they exist.
Well, I mean, let me ask you the boring, it's not a boring question. It's actually a really interesting question because everybody has a different answer. I mean, what draws you to this game? Why are you still playing it after, I don't mean all these years, but it has been some years.
No, these many years. At the end of the day, it's the people.
Yeah.
I just hate them so much.
I owe them all.
No. Some of the best people I've ever met in my life are diplomacy players. Something about the combination of the intelligence it requires to mm-hmm. manage the abstraction of the game with the communication skills it takes to persuade other people that they should do what you think is the right thing.
Right.
Just results in a mix of some of the really nicest, most friendly people you'd ever meet.
Yeah.
And that's really what draws me back. Because as a war game, you know, it's not a very good war game.
Yep.
As war games goes, you know, pushing units around the board, there are far more interesting, you know, simulations of military conflict.
Right.
If we're trying to do a World War I reproduce, you know, a reproduction right. of that, there's a lot better games.
Yeah. But the other thing is that the game mechanic that I really groove on is simultaneity.
Yeah.
I can't stand other games that take as long as diplomacy.
Because you have to sit around and wait for your turn.
You spend three quarters of the game waiting for somebody else to take their turn.
And they're just not interesting enough to watch. Like, you don't really care what the other guy is doing.
Yeah. As a sufferer of attention deficit disorder myself, I would agree that, yeah, that's absolutely.
I came into diplomacy through role-playing games, right?
Okay.
Through Dungeons & Dragons. through sort of having that as my main gaming experience. And the nice thing about Dungeons & Dragons is you get the same thing. You're always doing something, or you're preparing to do something, or you're planning on doing something. One of the saddest things about diplomacy is when you're that guy who's sitting at the table that nobody needs to talk to. And you're just...
Yeah. Yeah, no, that's the loneliest time, but it's almost waiting always brief.
Yeah.
So, right? And at the same time though, I mean, there's some people that wait to die, and there's those people that are like, I'm going to die anyway, but I'm going to talk to you, and I'm going to talk to you, and I'm going to talk to you.
Some of the best games, some of the most fun games are the ones where you're at two centers, mm-hmm. scrambling to get to a third, right?
You're
trying to convince people to not kill you because you're useful.
Yeah.
Right?
If nothing else, you can maybe wasted one guy's entire turn just talking to you, even though you only have one dot on the board.
Yeah.
I mean, those can be really, really fun games. And it's there are players out there that kind of give up if they go under three. And I think I have to agree. Like, one of the reasons I play this game is the people, and it is that situation where you have to give everything to just try and hang on. And it's a ton of fun.
And those moments when it all hinges on you making the right decision, reading somebody and talking to them and deciding that you know what it is they're going to do, and that means that your set of orders has to be this.
Yeah.
And the orders are red and you're right, right? That's a glorious feeling.
Yes, I agree.
It's also epic when somebody else does it to you.
Uh-huh.
even when you're the one going, oh my God, you completely boned me there. That's... You know, if you have to say, well done, sir. Clap, clap, clap. Well done.
Yeah, no, it's one of the rare games. It's one of the rare games in which when someone really just gets you and really just like puts one over on you and just like gets completely upper hand, you're really happy for them. You're just like, wow, that was amazing. Ah, you know, usually when you're in that situation, there's few games where someone just kind of owns you a little bit and you're not a little bit irritated or not a little really angry about it.
Yeah. All right. We're going to need to wrap up pretty soon, but I want to end on this. For a person who plays diplomacy, either face to face, online, or both, is, trying to get better.
Yeah.
If you could tell them one thing, the one thing that's going to help their game more than anything else, how to be a better diplomat, how to be a better tactician. What do you have any final advice?
It's not any final advice that doesn't sound platitudinous, I think.
Go for it. Platitude away, my friend.
Listen to what everyone else says, but follow your heart.
Wow, you really came through with that.
Yeah, when it comes to platitudes, you know, that one has a duck bill and clawed feet. So here's what I mean. A lot of newer players have an idea of what they want to do, but they don't listen to other people, or rather they don't hear what other people are saying.
Mm-hmm.
And so, for example, right, if you are Russia and England tells you he's opening to the channel, right?
Mm-hmm.
This should suggest to you that this is a game in which you might want to consider opening north, right? Because England isn't going to be sending enough force to defend Norway.
Sure.
Maybe not even enough to capture Norway. So you might be able to exploit that. And opening north of Russia is one of the hardest things to do, but if you can make it work, blah, 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 right?
Sure.
At the end of the day, though, a lot of people who listen become goldfish. And they do what the last person that they talk to tells them.
Yeah.
And I know that experienced diplomacy players angle to be the last person to talk to this person.
No, once it's apparent, yeah.
Oh yeah. Right? So and when you realize that you didn't talk to them last, your opponent did, you know how to fight to defend against them because you know they're coming for you.
Yep.
So listening is good, right? But doing what you think you need to do to advance your position is better. The other thing that I would say to a new player who wants to do well in a tournament situation, hitch your wagon to a star, right? Mm. Pick somebody, work with them, do what they say. Don't let anybody talk you off of them. And you will do better than if you bounce back and forth between working with them, working against them. They will probably do better than you, but you'll learn something from it.
Wow, that's interesting. And you'd say that you'll survive some games that way, and you'll get in some draws that way, because working with a really good player, a lot of times they'll end up needing you if you do it well. Yeah.
And what I'd say to a new player is this. My first tournament, I had two eliminations and a one center survival. Mm-hmm. Yeah. The next year, I won World Dipcon with a solo as England.
And we guarantee the same results if you follow Chris Martin's advice.
If you will send me $29.99, I will guarantee that you will have similar results. Similar results, not guaranteed.
Well, Chris, I really appreciate you coming by.
Hey guys,
thanks
for having me on your show. It's a kick-ass one.
Thank you. Thank you. We hope you listen to it also, what it's already.
I'm a big fan.
We'll talk to you soon, Chris.
All right. Bye-bye, guys.
Thanks. Bye-bye.